Hello, and welcome to the Para Aqua podcast, the science podcast that shines a light on the newest and most interesting research being conducted in the fields of aquatic and marine ecology. My name's Joe Money, I'm a PhD student and the host of this podcast. Today I'm joined by Dr. Jana Isanta-Navarro from the University of Copenhagen, and together we'll be discussing her research into the salinization of aquatic ecosystems and the impacts that this process is having on keystone species in freshwater environments. Jana, how are you doing?
I'm good. Hello, Joey, and thanks for inviting me.
Oh, no problem. It's a pleasure to have you on. It's been a busy week for you, or have things been all right?
No, it's been a fairly busy week, I would say. I
Okay.
just came back from an exciting visit to EAWAC in Zurich. So that was a nice exchange.
Nice. So let's jump straight into the questions. So could you give us a quick summary of your personal background, your education, and your research history?
Yeah, so I am originally from Germany. That's where I grew up, and that's also where I did my bachelor degree in environmental sciences in my hometown. That's Bielefeld. And after that, I wanted to specialize originally into marine biology, actually. And so for my graduate studies, for my master degree, I applied to, I think, almost 40 different universities. And only two of those actually offered marine biology. And those were the two that rejected me. So I
Always
didn't
the
end
way.
up, yeah, and didn't end up studying marine biology, but yeah, rather moved to Munich, where I studied evolution, ecology, and systematics, and then specialized in freshwater ecology in my master thesis. And then an interesting fact that normally don't see on my CVs, because I often also leave it out, is that after my master's, I was really fed up with academia and science. So I left and I worked for an environmental consulting office for almost a year, and also continued as a freelancer to work in that area throughout my PhD. So after almost 1 year break, I decided it was time to return and start off with a PhD, which I then did at the University of Konstanz at Lake Konstanz, where also was my research was about Lake Konstanz. Yeah, and after that, it got really exciting. So then I moved during COVID to the US, to the state of Montana, where I worked at the Fed at Lake Biological Station for the University of Montana for nearly 2 years. And then I took a postdoc position after that with Lund University in Sweden. And then around 1 year in my contract in Sweden, I got the fantastic opportunity to become a group leader, and I accepted a tenure track position as an assistant professor at the University of Copenhagen, where I am today since October 23.
Nice. That's an amazing research history. Is Lund just across the bridge from Copenhagen as well? So just
Yeah.
literally a nice drive, I guess, to move.
Yeah, in the beginning I was also commuting, made moving my personal life also easier. But you're absolutely right. It's just like an maybe a bit more than an hour, but depending on where you live in Denmark, you'll maybe take the same time. I have a few colleagues who, yeah, live a little bit further outside of Copenhagen, and they take around the same time to go into work. But now I'm
Awesome.
also living in Copenhagen, and yeah, it was just by coincidence, honestly, that this opened up in Copenhagen. I would have been fairly open to any. Yeah, permanent position within northern Western Europe, I would say.
Nice.
Yeah.
And what sort of ecological consultancy did you do when you were working there, when you were doing a bit of time away from academia?
Yeah, I really needed that, and I can actually also always advise everyone who is wondering, is academia really for me, to take a break and do something else and get to know the world outside of academia. So I was working mostly on the Water Framework Directive that we have in the European Union. So where we're monitoring the ecological status of streams and rivers and lakes. So I was involved in that mostly with scuba diving, actually, because that is used for
That's very
mapping
cool.
macrophytes. I really love that. And also the water structure mapping, so how straight a river is, and all sorts of substrate differences for river ecosystems.
Nice, cool. Well, I think we've all, I mean, I can speak for myself here that we've all sometimes got a bit frustrated with academia. So that's some good advice, I think, to think about life outside of it. And you know, you can always return as you did. That's a very good lesson, I guess, for our listeners.
And I think sometimes it also just gives some perspective, especially now where I'm also teaching lots of students, right? And not everyone is going to end up in academia, and that is great that we have all different interests and different strengths. So I think it's also great to have some perspective on what kind of jobs are out there and where do our graduates actually end up in.
Yep, that's a really great point. So, speaking of, you know, freshwater consultancy, I think that everyone remembers being told in school from a young age just how little freshwater there is on the planet, especially when compared to salty seawater. So the process of salinization, which a lot of your work is focused on, hopefully is a topic that gets the general public's attention. But how does salinization occur in your study system? Could you tell the listeners?
Yes, I think in general, people, of course, are aware that we have marine aquatic ecosystems where we, of course, have a fairly high salt concentration depending on which marine ecosystem we're looking at. The Baltic, for example, has a fairly low salt concentration, the Mediterranean, a much higher one. And then freshwater ecosystems should typically, an unpolluted one, maybe be around 10 to 50 milligrams per liter, maybe, of chloride. That's typically the ion that we're using for measuring salinization. And unpolluted freshwater ecosystems should typically have chloride concentrations around 10, maybe 50 milligrams per liter. And what we can see since the 1950s around that, due to anthropogenic impacts, is that we see an increase in these ion concentrations of chloride. And we do have freshwater ecosystems, so lakes, rivers, so any inland waters really that now experience salt levels or chloride levels of around 100 to 200 milligrams per liter. And that, of course, has quite a lot of impact for the ecosystem and for the ecosystem services also. And so the question, of course, is where does this salt come from, right? And there's a number of processes, and it really depends a lot on the background of what kind of ions are already in the freshwater ecosystem. So the ion concentration depends a lot on the soil history, on the underlying ground structure, essentially, of where the stream is flowing through or what kind of soil structure is underneath the lake. But where these elevated ion concentrations from chloride mostly come from will differ a lot in the Mediterranean. For example, it is more a matter of climate change and drought. So you can imagine if you have a certain amount of ions inside a freshwater body and the water is being reduced because of more evaporation, your concentration will rise, right? And then what we can see, especially in the northern hemisphere, is that we have an input from road salt, for example. So that is this salt that many countries, especially in the northern hemisphere, use for de-icing winter-maintained roads. We also have an input, and that is really relevant for many countries, regardless of their climate region, from agriculture. So salts are also used as fertilizers in agriculture. And then, of course, we also have rising sea levels. So more and more salty water from the marine system, especially in coastal areas, can also be transferred or spill over essentially into freshwater ecosystems.
Yeah, wow, that's a really diverse origin, I guess, of all of these different salinization effects. I actually really only had one in my head, and it was the road salt. So, despite being an ecologist, I have to admit that I have very little knowledge of the effects of salinization on ecosystems in general. So, could you explain to both me and the audience how increasing salt levels in freshwater systems are negatively impacting plant and animal communities?
Yeah, so I guess it's really, I mean, ions. That's just not that's that can't just be or is not only a problem for the ecosystem for freshwater ecosystems, but can of course also be a problem, especially when we're talking about road salt application as a source for salt, also for terrestrial organisms that maybe live close to these winter maintained roads. It's really a matter for, or a problem for all sorts of organisms living in the ecosystems that have to balance their own internal ion concentrations. So it's about the osmotic stress, essentially, where we have and all living cells, all living animals have cells, and we have a certain ion concentration inside our body, essentially. And when we have a higher ion concentration outside in the environment than we have internally, then it essentially leads to a flux of these ions inside. So what is going to happen is there's always going to be an equilibrium between the internal and external ion concentration. So what happens when organisms are exposed to a high external ion concentration is that we have a diffusion of these ions into the organismal cells. And yeah, that essentially leads to dehydration. So water is being secreted out of the cells, and yeah, a dehydrating organism, of course, has a lot of negative implications, not just for the population of organisms, but also for the ecosystem themselves. And ultimately, it's one of the chemical parameters, physical chemical parameters that we use for defining also ecosystem health. There is a reason why we can infer a lot about ecosystem health from chloride concentrations, for example. That's also one of the reasons why it is one of the monitored parameters under the Water Framework Directive in the European Union, for example. And many countries actually have thresholds on how much chloride can be or should be in freshwater bodies.
I see. So it's very much about controlling this osmotic potential across cellular membranes. I'm guessing that's going to contribute to the effects in plants, in bacteria, in animals. I guess that makes it such a big threat to ecosystems because it can affect all of these
Exactly.
forms of life.
Exactly. And ultimately, of course, also us, right? Because we also utilize freshwater. And you said earlier that, of course, freshwater or freshwater surface bodies are a very small part of all the water that we have on our amazing blue planet. But it is also, I think we will all agree on that, an incredibly important resource that we as humans also have, and that we really, I think, also start to treasure more and more, especially in wealthier, European countries where we were not used to having a shortage of water, for example, of fresh water.
Yeah, I mean, I'm currently recording this in the UK, and you're currently recording this in Denmark. So, in the middle of winter, water is not something that I think we have a shortage of, or so it seems, but it definitely can be going forward. And especially, maybe too much water at some times and not enough water at other times could be a real sort of hazardous byproduct of climate change in our regions
Exactly.
as well as tropical ones.
Exactly.
So, as I understand it, you're focusing your research on zooplankton, a well-known keystone species in aquatic ecology. But what direct impacts has salinization had on this species? And can you also explain why this species was selected for your research?
Yeah, so I would say within my research, I mostly focus on planktonic organisms and lake ecosystems. So planktonic organisms are organisms that are freely floating in the water column of a lake. Many people are aware of plankton in marine systems, but they also exist in freshwater ecosystems. So I'm mostly focusing on phytoplankton, so on the small plants in this planktonic community, and also on zooplankton, as you said, so small animals. And there we often use water fleas. They're also called Daphnia. And with these water fleas, why much of the research is focused on, I think, has multiple reasons. So one, they are really often used for ecotoxicological risk assessments and studies. So they're very often used in order to establish guidelines that are supposed to protect freshwater ecosystems, for example, to understand what kind of threshold should we actually establish. And then they are keystone species. So they are species that can alter the entire ecosystem functioning. The transfer of nutrients from one level, from the producers, the phytoplankton, to higher trophic levels, the consumers, such as fish, for example. So they're really important for transferring these nutrients. So there's chain of food transfer in a freshwater system. And without those, one might argue we will have a collapse of the entire function within a lake, and that will ultimately also have consequences for humans again. So I think there's multiple reasons why it is important to study these organisms, But it's just as important to also phytoplankton and also other parts of freshwater organisms to really understand how differential these salinization effects can be on our organisms inside the lake.
Yep. I always try to explain, because I work with Daphnia myself, these little water fleas. When you're trying to explain the importance to people who aren't scientists, they're like, why aren't you working with a more interesting or more charismatic organism? But the truth is that these animals, they do form a very key stage between sort of carbon fixing photosynthetic organisms, and then the higher level of animals that can then prey on the Daphnia, where they've turned that plant matter into animal matter. So yeah, it can be frustrating to explain, but yeah, it seems like a really good choice for your studies in particular.
Yeah, it does. And I would say we've recently also, and I think this is how the entire community of especially road salt contamination into freshwater ecosystems really started off with, is a lot of work on Daphnia. But there is more and more evidence also coming and more and more studies and research being conducted on phytoplankton. That's also something we are currently very active with in my lab or in my group. Also with water fleas still, but we're also looking more and more into the differential responses of different phytoplankton groups, because that is also one of the effects that we can see from salinization, is that we have different groups of phytoplankton dominating freshwater ecosystems depending on the salt concentration. And that can really have very severe consequences also. So it's not just important to understand what the zooplankton does, but also what other trophic levels does to, for example, phytoplankton. I don't know. I think maybe some of our listeners, maybe you, since you, I think, did your PhD or still doing your PhD in Poland, also heard about what happened in the Oder River in 2022, I think. Was that, and what happened there is that we had an increase of salt in a freshwater river, right? Which is not supposed to have a lot of, high iron concentration of chloride. And very likely this increase in salinity led to the mass blooming, mass formation, mass occurrence of a phytoplankton species that was very toxic for other organisms in this river. So it's a really important driver that can lead to entire community changes in our freshwater ecosystems that can really alter the entire nature of this ecosystem.
Yeah, and that's a great example as well, because the Oder River goes between Germany and Poland, so it's a really crucial resource for both of those countries, but they both have to work together, and they both exist in the watershed of that river. So if one of them, they both need to be playing by the same rules and both need to control their chloride pollution. And yeah, it's definitely one to it's a good case study for things going forward, I think, for how to reduce pollution, and what can happen if you don't.
Yeah, and also in my work at the consulting offices, and also as a freelancer afterwards doing my PhD, this is one of the very common tasks that you're also being faced with, that there's companies who want to put their wastewater in, of course treated often, into river systems, and then you're actually measuring, for example, chloride concentrations in these wastewaters, and then calculate how much water mass do we have in the stream, in the river where this is supposed to end up in, and is this going to lead to concentrations above or below thresholds that are actually environmentally acceptable or not? And another great example is the Rhine River, another border river between Germany and the Netherlands, for example, and that used to have huge problems with chloride concentrations already in the 1950s and 1960s because of all the industry that was doing exactly what I just described, putting chloride containing wastewater into that river system.
Yeah, it's definitely an issue to think of going forward, and now that's another thing that I have to think about, the salinization effects. I always say that when I do this podcast, I always learn about another problem that I hadn't known before, and now I'm going to be thinking about that at night and not getting to sleep.
And there's just so many, right? I mean, I
There
think
are,
humanity
yeah.
is so creative in ways of polluting ecosystems. It's unbelievable. Yeah, it's
Yeah.
really sad.
It unfortunately is, yeah. So one thing I always try to bear in mind with this type of research is that when anthropogenic forces cause ecosystems to rapidly change, so for example, the pollution of these rivers, or the result of temperature increase, or general salinization. This change doesn't happen in isolation. So, has your research incorporated other effects that have influenced zooplankton during this study period, as well as salt? Because I can imagine the salinization comes hand in hand with so many other effects. Am I right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So, I think what we in the beginning were, of course, trying to understand how, and many researchers from around the world have really been working together on that, how species specific do these guidelines that we currently have in order to protect our freshwater ecosystems actually have to be? I already said that most often there's a certain species of water fleas being used to establish these guidelines. And what we've seen now in the past decade, I would say, is really how species specific these guidelines should actually be in order to protect the freshwater biodiversity so that we can have very locally different individuals, different species living there. And the guidelines that we have currently do not protect this biodiversity, but actually have been established on organisms that are very, not very sensitive towards chloride compared to other species in the same group of organisms. And what we've seen in some of the research that I have been involved in, for example, is that it also depends a lot on what kind of food they have available. So when we're talking about water fleas, we already said that they belong to zooplankton and they are grazing on phytoplankton. So they take up phytoplankton and they also get a lot of nutrients. You already mentioned the important role of nutrient transfer also between these trophic levels. So what really happens is that we have different phytoplankton that differ in their nutritional quality for zooplankton. And we have a few groups of phytoplankton that are really inadequate. So they lack a lot of essential lipids. And these essential lipids are important for maintaining all sorts of physiological properties in animal cellular functions and animal organisms, really. And one of them, for example, is their role in the membrane. And now membranes are becoming really important again when we're thinking of osmotic stress and ions diffusing in and out of cells, right? So depending on what kind of phytoplankton food source and lipid concentration they have, this can either be advantageous, so they can tolerate more of the salt stress, or it can be actually quite detrimental and they can tolerate less. And that is because the incorporation of these lipids into the membrane makes the membrane less or more permeable. So they can actively modulate the permeability of the membrane, but of course depend on a certain resource supply, right, from the phytoplankton community. And we're not quite there yet to finalize this conclusion, but the idea behind is that blue-green algae, cyanobacteria, many listeners probably will have heard about that before. That's typically those little critters that are to blame when there is a lake close in summer and you're not allowed to bathe in that because they can also be toxic. Not all of them are toxic, but all of them typically lack these essential lipids that are so important for modulating the membrane permeability, for example. And what we can see in a few preliminary studies, and I think a couple of them are being published also this year, is that cyanobacteria potentially benefit from salinization. So they are one group of phytoplankton that would increase when we have more salt concentrations in our freshwater ecosystems. And then the idea could be that when we have an increase of those cyanobacteria that of course also have a number of other consequences for the freshwater ecosystem, we would also have a less supply of these essential nutrients for the zooplankton community, which potentially will put them even more at risk when there is this double stress of having inadequate nutrient supply because of cyanobacterial blooms, and at the same time, maybe also a salinization problem in the freshwater body that they're living in. So that is one of these examples where we really are only at the beginning of understanding how intricate these problems can be and how they're all connected. And I think another example also could be, for example, 6-PPD has a very, very complicated chemical name, which I'm not even going to try to pronounce, but I can, of course, quickly explain what 6-PPD is. So 6-PPD is an anti-ozonant that is typically used in car rubber tire, for example. So it's essentially a chemical that is supposed to keep the rubber nice and soft and not harden the rubber when it is exposed to radiation, for example, when we're driving with these tires, of course, on our cars outside. And now what you can imagine, and there is also a reason why your tires have to have a certain profile, right, in order to be safe to drive on, because you're rubbing off this tire, you're wearing it off essentially. And in this tire rubber is the 6 PPD contained, and it's broken down also by UV radiation into all sorts of different derivatives that end up into our freshwater ecosystems. And we could show, for example, that there's a synergistic effect. So the input of salt and 6 PPD together is even more detrimental to the zooplankton community than each of these stressors alone are. So the really bad combination, of course, of such a chemical that can lead to death, for example, also in fish. So we said before, many people maybe don't care about zooplankton, but 6 PPD has been shown to be relevant for meth kills, really, of coho salmon in Canada and in the northern United States a couple of years ago. So it's really a contaminant that we are also starting only to learn about that is also, of course, affected when we have snow melt, for example. When we have snow melt in the spring, we will have a wash off of these contaminants that are also on the street, because that's where the tires are rubbed off, right, from our cars. And in the same moment, we also have the wash off from the salt that was maybe used for de-icing the road. So we really have an influx into our freshwater ecosystem with these two stresses at the same time, and that can really pose a big stress to many different aquatic organisms. And I already said very sensitive are especially salmonid fish species, but we've been working on some rotifers, some smaller zooplankton that have a that also graze on phytoplankton and phytoplankton itself on this study. And yeah, it was yeah I think there's a long, long list of other stresses that we could potentially list, but we're only really beginning to understand what kind of consequences one stressor can have on amplifying the effects of salt contamination in freshwater ecosystems.
Yeah, there's sounds like there's at least three multipliers of sort of negative effects on the aquatic ecosystems that you were talking about there. And yeah, when you're talking about some forms of food helping Daphnia and helping water fleas adapt to the salinization process, well, that sounds really good, right? But water fleas and Daphnia are filter feeders, aren't they? So it's not like they can selectively feed, I think. I'm not sure if they have that
Exactly.
ability to selectively feed on the food that would make them more resistant to this salinization. So I guess unfortunately the fact that they're filter feeders makes them great bioindicators, makes them great tests for ecotoxicology, but it also means that they can't selectively feed on this food that's going to make them more robust to the effects of human ecosystem sort of degradation, which is very sad. And yeah, there's so many times in science, isn't it, where there are two things going on and they basically stack together and their effect is multiplied, often negatively, unfortunately. But yeah, it's very interesting to see the effects of that, and very well explained.
Yeah, definitely. And I think one can think of, you already correctly said that it's really about that they can't select a certain phytoplankton species. So you can think of the phytoplankton community maybe as a sort of cocktail that is made of different parts, right? And what they really need is a certain percentage of nutritious phytoplankton inside this phytoplankton community cocktail in order to have enough nutrients that they can take up, because as you said, they can't choose to increase a certain part of this cocktail. They will just take up the entire cocktail, and the frequency of that nutritious phytoplankton has to be high enough.
A phytoplankton cocktail, definitely not something I'm going to be ordering the next time I'm at a bar, but it's a nice analogy.
Maybe we should start with that, huh?
You before me, you before me. So, now this might be a little bit beyond the scope of your research, but are there mitigation strategies that you've researched or heard of that might be able to shield freshwater bodies from the effects of salt and other forms of automotive pollution or agricultural pollution, perhaps like using plants to remediate and filter out the salts before they get to the vulnerable ecosystems?
Yeah. So So I guess what most of the research in the last decade and what we've ourselves also been publishing on really is that we need politicians to listen and that we need politicians to lower the thresholds. They are too high. They are currently, and there's plenty of studies from all sorts of different countries because this really is a problem that not just the European Union has, also Northern America really is at the forefront of this problem, and we should really learn and not get into the same situation that colleagues back there are already in. We need to really lower these thresholds, and we need to have site-specific thresholds. So we need to really understand that we, in order to protect our freshwater ecosystems, we can't just have one generic threshold that is applicable to all freshwater bodies, but we need to understand what kind of other contaminants maybe do we have in this area. Is it an area that is, or freshwater body that is highly impacted by urban areas? Is it maybe very agricultural? Because all of these factors, of course, will influence what kind of other contaminants do we get into this freshwater body, but also what kind of community can we probably expect in these freshwater bodies. So that's really, I think, one of the demands that all of the publications in the last decade have really made, that politicians need to look at the evidence that we have in the sciences, in the studies that have been published on this, and that we need to lower these thresholds. And then I think there's also, especially for road salt, there's very, very hands-on advice and also solutions that are partially also coming from developing technology, which I think in many fields is a really something to look forward to that can be really an aid to many, many problems in the future. So what we, for example, know is that road salt applied in the solid form is less effective than when it is first brought into solution and sprayed on in a liquid form. So then it's not just more effective, so we need less, which is also great because you can typically convince stakeholders by monetary effects, right? So it will be more cost efficient. You will have to spend less on that once you have the right machines. You will actually save some money on maintaining your roads in winter. But then there's also many regions within Germany, for example, but also in other countries where the use of road salt is, for example, prohibited for people like you and me, for de-icing our pathways right in front of our houses, our sidewalks, essentially. Unfortunately, even though it is illegal in many cities to use that, it is still sold in hardware stores. So, that's a discrepancy I also don't really understand. When it is illegal to use, why is it still allowed to be sold? Of course, it's really not a rule or a law that is very universal, and not even within the same state. Sometimes there are differences just between different cities. So I think having a more equal distribution of these rules and laws would make it also easier. But as citizens, we can also really have an impact there and use, for example, not salt in order to de-ice our sidewalks, but for example, other solutions. You can throw on sand. You can use small gravel, for example. And anyone who doesn't really care about salt in terms of freshwater should latest care about their beloved cars, and that is often a selling point for Germans because Germans really tend to love their cars, right? So that is also not great to have on your car. It's leading to corrosion,
Rusting,
right? So exactly. So I don't understand really. And I think a really funny story is that there's also really hope. There are cities who have really great innovations. There's, for example, an area in Bavaria in Germany that is using that is has a lot of cucumber pickle, like pickling cucumbers. So yeah, this production, and what is used in the process of pickling cucumber is salt.
Brian,
So
yeah.
what they're doing is that they're taking this wastewater from the cucumber factories for pickling the cucumbers, and they're spraying this cucumber water on the streets. And I think this is such an ingenious solution, right? Because we're also saving resources there. I'm very well aware, and most of my colleagues who are also researching into this topic are aware that we, of course, need to apply salt very often in order to keep our roads safe for everyone, in order to also ultimately save human life, because we're interested in safe driving in winter. But we really need to work on our application technologies And ultimately also on our resources, right? Because also chloride is not an infinite resource we have on this planet. And if we already are mining it in order to pickle cucumbers, so why not double use that salt? And after pickling it for cucumbers, use it and spray it onto our roads. So I think these kind of technologies are really giving hope, I think at least. But yeah, we really need to have politicians looking more into the evidence that we have in academia in science, and it is really there. You don't have to look very hard in order to find it. There's lots of colleagues in every country working on this problem. And then I think what you mentioned about plants, for example, maybe being able to take up before salt could get into our freshwater systems. I think there it really depends a lot on what are the causes for salinization, right? I mean, we've discussed in the beginning how diverse they really are. So I would say it will probably be, could be locally very, very difficult. But of course, in general, what applies to a healthy freshwater ecosystem for many stressors applies also for all salt contamination or in general for salinization, is that when you have an intact freshwater ecosystem, and that includes a proper surrounding terrestrial environment, trees, for example, delivering shadow onto our river systems, right? And these plants can also really take up contaminants, and that's just not valid for salt, but also for other contaminants. They really act as a filtering zone before contaminants can reach our freshwater ecosystems. They're really like the mangroves for marine ecosystems. They're really like a buffer, these trees and shrubs around our freshwater habitats. So yeah, that is just a general solution, I think, for the future, that we need to get these back surrounding our freshwater ecosystems, all these shrubs and trees, and yeah, that would help in general a
Definitely,
lot.
yeah. A very well answered question, and I have to go back to my favorite part of that answer, which is the cucumber plan. Because
Yeah.
having briefly lived in Germany and also Poland, I know that people in that part of the world, they love pickled stuff. I've never seen so many
Oh,
pickled
yeah.
things in my life, but yeah, there's more than enough of that salty water to go around. So definitely a good idea. And I definitely will have to try and visit one of these Bavarian towns that uses the water that way, because I wonder if it smells pickly or if it's
No, it actually does not, because that's, I think, what many people were also worried about. Many citizens were worried about when this became public, but it really doesn't. So I think this is, and like you said, there's so many countries also in Scandinavia. They love pickled onions. They love pickled cucumbers. So many pickled products. So there has to be other places where we could use the same technology. But of course, it requires an investment in changing the machines that actually apply the salt, because it's a different if you apply it in a solid form, if you can, or if you have to spray on a liquid, right? And by the way, if I can add, the application of the salty liquid also leads to less spray spill for the surrounding areas. So you can really more directly apply it on the road without salt spraying all over the sidewalks and also plant terrestrial communities along these winter maintained roads. So thumbs up for this application in many, many ways.
Definitely, yeah. And I was hoping for a science answer because science is easy, but unfortunately, it's a politics answer and politics is hard. So, yeah,
Yeah.
unfortunately, that's just how it is, isn't it? Sometimes where all of these
Yeah.
things, they come back to the decisions that we make, and it's not always easy to get people to agree on the right option, let's say.
Yeah, I think that is sometimes probably one of the frustrating parts in our jobs, where I think, and that's now maybe true more than ever, that we have politicians in power that tend to ignore evidence and science, even though it is very evident. And the effects of salinization and also potential solutions, we all agree on that. So that's not really, there's not even a scientific debate. It's actually very clear, and we have very clear evidence here. So it's a matter of listening to evidence.
A very applicable statement, not just to salinization, but other elements of climate change, for example. But yeah, let's not get bogged down too far in this, otherwise
Nope.
I think we're both going to pull our hair out. But yeah.
Yeah.
So finally, you've talked about the sort of the effects of salt spraying and this sort of winter influx of melting snow and salt from the roads that comes in during the spring and with the snow melts. So a lot of my like sampling trips have happened during the autumn and winter, which have often involved freezing cold hours on the lake with wet hands and wet legs, given the wintry and, yeah, with, sorry, I'm going to go back. So given the wintry theme of this research, were you exposed to similar conditions during your sampling trips, or did you manage to stay warm in the lab? And if you were on the lake, did you have any clever tricks to stay warm during your years of research?
Yeah, so I would say maybe another reason why I quit work in environmental consulting offices because what we as researchers, even on this very wintry theme, as you mentioned it, do is that we take the salt concentrations. Very often we don't monitor them ourselves, but we actually rely on these governmental monitoring programs. So we tend to not really go outside ourselves in order to
You're very
monitor the
lucky.
salt levels. I know, right? But in my work as a consultant, I obviously was one of the people who was, for example, recording these data. So maybe that was an unconscious decision point why I also came back. But yeah, I'm very fortunate in that sense that most of my research is lab-based. So very cozy temperatures also in the winter. But during my
That's
time
nice.
back then, yeah, I mostly had, I guess, a good investment into footwear.
Nice.
I would say this is looking back, I think my hardest lessons learned there were actually in my time in Montana.
Oh yeah.
Because
Gets
now I
cold up
actually
there.
have now I have the proper footwear in order to survive really cold winters. Because
Yeah.
there we went up to minus 30 degrees Celsius in the winter. So
Blimey.
that is a different story than what we have typically in our temperate
Yeah.
Europe.
Yeah,
Yeah.
nice. I think for me it was just carrying a flask of tea with me.
Yeah.
I sometimes actually, because I'd be taking samples and the water would sort of run down my arms onto my legs, and even though I had sort of waterproof trousers, they weren't doing a great job. So I often just sat in a boat with a plastic bag on my lap, which didn't feel very scientific, but it did help quite a lot.
But isn't it interesting, no, how all the waterproof gear is really being put to a test by people like
Oh
us,
yes.
where you feel like, okay, this might be waterproof for walking your dog, but not for really
Yes, that's exactly it.
working
It's stress
outside.
testing.
But yeah, I'm not surprised by your tea answer coming from the UK, so.
Yeah, of course. I know it's a bit of a stereotype, but it's true. Yeah, coffee and hot chocolate work too, I'm sure. But yeah, that was for me. So Jana, it's been fantastic to talk to you. I've really enjoyed this interview, and I really hope that the relevant decision makers in our society listen to it as well, because I think you gave a lot of really good advice. And yeah, it's been great to chat, and thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Para Aqua podcast was funded by COST, the European Cooperation in Science and Technology, and is a product of the Para Aqua Action Group. If you are interested in joining an action group or just want to know more, please go to www.paraaqua-cost.eu or follow the link in the episode description. The podcast is produced by myself and Serena Rasconi, and the Science Communication Coordinator is Anna Gavrilovich. Once again, thanks for listening, and see you next time on the Para Aqua podcast.